This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. The great state of Wisconsin is home to the only master cheesemaking program outside of Switzerland. Learn more about Wisconsin's cheesemaking history at wisconsincheese.com.
Why is Heritage Radio Network important to you?
HRN is very nostalgic to go into because it's really the only place that you have this really warm, homey experience to watch people get together and talk about the things that really make a difference.
It's really fun when I ask guests, do you want to be on Heritage? And they're like, at Roberta's? Yes, 100%.
I believe that we all are really trying to bring people together.
I think getting more people excited about good, local, well-crafted food and away from big ag and tasteless commodity food is so important.
It's kind of an honor to be sitting there with so many in a space where so many other people have sat.
Join HRN's vibrant community of thoughtful eaters. Become a member today. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, career changers, cool people, wacky people, interesting people, myself not included, I think.
Definitely included.
I'm Ethan Frisch, your co-host.
I'm Valerie Lomas, your co-host as well.
And we have a cool guest to introduce to you, but we're going to keep you in suspense for a couple of minutes while we talk about Valerie's Thanksgiving in Germany, in particular, a pecan pie? Am I remembering that right?
This is correct. Yes.
That you made with an old wine bottle?
Yeah. Okay. So to be honest, it was actually an empty rum bottle. Because when you're staying in a house with like nine of your college friends,
There's a lot of empty bottles.
We ended up calling it the real world Berlin. But yeah, we went to Germany for Thanksgiving. We had a huge Friendsgiving celebration. And pretty much at the last minute, I was told that I was expected to make a pecan pie.
I mean, that can't be surprised. Like, people have got to expect that you're bringing baked goods pretty much anywhere you go.
I mean, well, yeah, but I was given like specific marching orders. So when I travel, I make sure I have things that I need. But I didn't have basic things like, you know, I made an old school one, Cairo syrup. So we ended up going on this whole quest to find the ingredients. We ended up freestyling it using an old rum bottle filled with water to give it some weight to roll out the crust. And it all came out really fun. And one of my friends, she's a producer, so she made a video of this. And it's on my Instagram page. I think it was just really fun. And it shows just like innovation and like the love that you find at all Thanksgiving tables.
And how hard it is to find high fructose corn syrup in
German other countries. And it's also hard to find pecans. But yes, high fructose corn. Well, you know what? Cairo
it's
is
not high fructose.
High fructose.
You're right. I'm exaggerating.
Fake news, Ethan.
I'm going for the cheap shot. You're right.
But, you know, you just got back from Armenia.
I did. I went for a friend's wedding. But obviously, I had to do some spice sourcing things while I was there.
And what did you find?
Well, Armenia has an amazing, as I learned recently, an amazing tradition of wild herbs harvested up in the mountains, mostly for medicinal uses. People make all kinds of teas and broths and other things using these wild plants. So there's a variety of wild thyme that smells a little like mint. There's a flower called Zizifora, which I had never heard of at all, but it has this sort of beautiful, like fruity and minty flavor.
Is it an herb or?
It's an herb and a flower, yeah.
Oh, for tea.
Yeah,
steeping.
Exactly. Okay. And then Armenia is also famous for its stone fruit, apricots, plums, peaches. So we had several shots of a homemade peach vodka, something distilled with peaches at the market at like 10:30 in the morning because this guy was excited to show off his homemade
vodkas. Was it cold there?
I would say about New York temperature, okay. around freezing and wet and kind of icky, but
perfect for vodka in the morning.
But
then
perfect for vodka at 10:30 in the morning, and really nice to be there for my friend's wedding, which was really the
awesome.
Point.
I love it. Well, can you introduce our
with
amazing guest?
With pleasure. Hannah Wong is the executive chef of Van Da and Real Food Catering. Van Da is an amazing modern Vietnamese restaurant in the East Village of Manhattan, recently very positively reviewed in the New York Times and has gotten a lot of other great press and is delicious in all ways. And we'll obviously get a little get into more detail about how it's distinct and the kind of food that you make. So Hannah, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. It's a very, very, very much my pleasure to be with you guys today.
And you, as with all of our guests, have had a story of career change. Tell us about Indeed. Where you started your career and how you wound up where you are today.
Oof. Okay. How far back do you want me to go?
when do you start counting your career trajectory?
I always find it interesting what people studied in college, because it's like, you know, when we're seniors in high school and checking the boxes of like what classes we're about to take, it's always interesting. So can we start there?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's funny because I think in order to start there, I have to back up even a little bit farther because I think like a lot of children who grow up with immigrant parents, there are certain expectations for what you should study in college. And my parents were no different. So, you know, the expectation was going into some sort of pre-med or pre-law program where your career track was sort of well-defined. And I almost did that. I almost did enter a 7-year pre-med program.
Like a Bach MD?
Yes.
Oh my
yes,
gosh.
Exactly. And thankfully, I did not. So I ended up going to a liberal arts school and I ended up studying English and biology. So that was college. And then...
How did you talk your parents out of the pre-med, pre-law?
I didn't. I just did the things. And I think there was a lot of shock for them, maybe. And a long period of adjustment, I think, that's still ongoing. I think that's from my perspective, a challenge of being a parent is that you at some point just really cannot control what your children are going to do. And I think that, I think it's good for them to sort of step back and just like let their children out into the world and, you know, they're gonna fuck up. Maybe, probably, but
hopefully,
yeah, that's part. That's part.
Yeah, in manageable ways.
Yes, screw up sooner than later.
Okay, yeah,
I've heard someone say like fail fast.
I'm gonna make a T-shirt. Valerie Lomas says,
"I love
screw
that.
Up
fail
soon."
Fast.
I mean, yeah. No, fail fast. Like if you're gonna fail at something, right? Like let's not spend years doing it. Like figure out at what point, oh, maybe this isn't the right path and
are
maybe there's a different path.
I'm
not.
Sounds a little bit like you are.
No, I was told this from someone actually earlier this year, but I love that you were a double major.
Yes.
English and biology. Mm-hmm. So that biology, you a little bit left a path open for like a pre-med career.
Yeah.
But English is you know, it's mostly literature that you're studying, right?
Right.
Which is very, a completely different side of your brain.
I do like to think that I do enjoy using both sides of my brain. So that was, yeah, that was definitely part of the rationale.
And do you find that now in your cooking style that you're using both that kind of like literature, analytical and creative side, but also this like more evidence-based practical science side of things?
Yeah, I don't know that I can really sort of like define when I'm using those parts of my brain, but the other thing about cooking that I actually really enjoy, I think, is kind of like neither of those things. It's much more the like instinctive sort of visceral satisfaction that I get from working with products and, you know, manipulating them in a way that makes them tasty and interesting.
I interrupted your story earlier. I apologize. You finished college and then...
I did finish college. I graduated from college.
I bet your parents loved that, right?
They attended my college graduation, which, you know,
with lots of pride, I'm sure.
Yeah, so after that, I was still considering going into law, actually, during college. A lot of my summers I spent doing law internships and things like that. So, you know, that was... And then I think I probably would have been, like, a fine lawyer. But, like...
You seem so excited about the idea.
You know, that would have been, like, a fail fast, hopefully, thing where I, like, did it. And I was like, oh, this is really not... This is not going to go well.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the thing about law school, I'm just going to jump in. And the problem with failing fast in law school is it's a 3-year program, and you would have to have like the gumption to drop out. So who's
and
really?
And I don't think I would have a lot of trouble dropping out.
School. No one is really like, if you're like you've been like an achiever, or overachiever all of your school life, it would take a whole lot to just be in your first year of law school and drop out.
Yeah.
But anyway, so you saved yourself.
So I
didn't go to law school.
Yeah. So I decided to delay my adulthood, I guess, for a year, and so I actually traveled. I was in Hong Kong after college. I spent a year based in Hong Kong and just doing a lot of traveling when I could. And that was super eye-opening. I didn't really have a chance to travel much internationally as a child. So, yeah.
Eye-opening in what ways?
I think living anywhere unfamiliar and is bound to change you. And I think especially my parents are from China and Hong Kong, so I think there was a lot of pull in that sense, going back and not like reliving their steps, but just kind of like getting a better sense of like where they came from. And also, you know, I spent a lot of time traveling. Most of the time that I was able to travel, I wanted to spend in Southeast Asia because those cultures and countries were just super, I'd never been there, but I just felt like they would be really interesting and, people and food that I would gravitate toward. And so I had the opportunity to do that. And that really, I think, you know, in Southeast Asia, that was sort of when I thought about how food really, it's just so integral to culture and place. And I think when you're just living your life wherever you are, it doesn't strike you the same way, right? It's when you're sort of in a new place that those sorts of mundane, maybe, realizations come to the surface in impactful ways.
Are there particular dishes or culinary techniques or even just experiences related to food that you had in that period that stick with you, that really stood out?
Yeah, definitely. There's a few. I mean, I think in Hong Kong specifically, the strongest food memory I have is, actually the program that I was in was based in Tai Po. That's the American, that's the English pronunciation of the Cantonese, but it's sort of a more rural area. It's not like commercial urban Hong Kong, like I think most people sort of associate with the area. It's very old and traditional. Still a lot of, it's kind of like a fishing village, I want to say, and it's very close to the border with China. I think it's the last stop on the metro there. But anyway, so there's a sort of like a town center there, and I remember going there to have like a very traditional wonton egg noodle dish, and that's sort of a very powerful memory for me during my time in Hong Kong. But
is there something that's kind of similar?
And also that's my dad's favorite dish from Hong Kong. So I that was kind of, I think, where that came from.
Oh, nice. So you're kind of like drawing in on your parents' experiences.
Yeah, I went there for myself, but also, you know, seeking maybe the sorts of experiences that my parents recalled having there, you know, way back in the day. I guess one specific memory I have of Southeast Asia food related is a bunch of us took a trip, like a 3 or 4 day trip, just to Penang in Malaysia. And literally just, I think we must have, like in 3 days, we probably ate like 18. I mean, we were just literally eating. Like we would go to one place and then digest for like 20 minutes as we walked or like, you know, went to the next place. And it was just like a sequence of nonstop eating. But there is, I mean, Penang is like a crazy, amazing, like hodgepodge of like so many different cuisines, and that was incredible.
Yeah, I one of the first trips that
my, and also good spices, like
great spices
there.
Yeah, nutmeg. One of the first trips that my now wife and I took together was to Penang, And yeah, I think we must have eaten 20 dishes a day, like spent the whole, planned the
How can
whole
you
day
know,
around.
I mean, you just have to, if you're there, you just kind
you
of
just,
have to.
Because yeah, stuff that you don't get anywhere else. There was a woman, a chef, a street vendor cooking the char kway teow, which is like the classic Penang stir-fried noodle dish with duck eggs and shrimp and...
Just like shit that they...
Yeah, whatever.
Like whatever. Yeah.
And she's wearing like fighter pilot goggles and she... I don't... Like the... Yeah, you see...
The woman in Thailand
who had Chef's Table episode about her, but
no,
yes.
She has a Michelin star now.
Oh, wow. Wow, amazing. So yeah, anyway, these like street vendors who are so specific and so focused and make this one dish, I don't know how many thousands of times over the course of their lives, and it just
it's perfection.
Can you imagine? Yeah, on the other end, I personally cannot imagine doing that for my entire making one dish.
The same dish, like, standing on a milk crate outside on the street, making the same dish over and over again. Yeah, it's an approach.
It is, and I feel like our generation.
We're just flaky.
I don't think flaky is fair.
There's a little judgment in that.
I'm a little judgmental of it. I'm flaky.
I mean, I think we have our hands in a few different pots. I think that's kind of what it is to quote unquote be successful today, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of the chefs that we see that we aspire to be, they don't just have restaurants. They have like full on empires, and these restaurants they're constantly evolving and there's stuff always happening. And even outside of food, it just seems like today people aren't just honed in and focused on like one thing, whether it's like making this stir fry noodle dish or like where I'm from in South Louisiana, it would be like that one person that sold. They only sold watermelons. That's what they did. Whereas today, it's just, I think everyone has just kind of like diversified everything, right? And so, I don't know. I'm wondering, you know, are we going to have noodles that have been perfected by one person making them for decades every single day? Are we going to have that in the future?
Maybe not. If our generation isn't stepping up to be that noodle maker.
I don't think we're gonna have that. But
we do have amazing Vietnamese restaurants in the East Village that are cooking spectacular food and maybe have not made the same exact dish 10 million times, but I think they do a pretty good job.
I wanted to actually ask you, you talked about this like this really like amazing noodle dish that you had that was like really impactful for you. Is there something on your current menu that you serve that was kind of inspired by that?
No. So Vanda is we label it a modern Vietnamese restaurant, and a lot of the dishes are actually based. I'm not Vietnamese. My boss is from Central Vietnam, and so a lot of the dishes that we have on the menu are. I would say half of them are rooted in traditional regional Vietnamese dishes that she specifically wanted to bring to New York and just hasn't been able to find here. And so that's kind of the inspiration for a lot of the menu. And then the other stuff is, it's kind of like her being like, hey, can you do something like this? This is sort of a dish that that's Vietnamese, but can you interpret it in a way that's interesting and you know, make it your own.
So it's been kind of a collaborative process.
Absolutely.
With building the menu.
Absolutely collaborative, and I think that's part of the that's a lot of what I like about cooking also is maybe some people define their style of cooking as I know they're kind of in their head and that's sort of like their very single-minded vision. But for me, cooking is collaboration, and I don't think that I would find it rewarding if I wasn't able to bounce ideas off someone or like draw inspiration from someone else and sort of then interpret that in a way that's personal, because cooking is also personal, right? So
can you give us an example of a dish on the menu that has drawn from all those influences?
Sure. So the bo luk lak is also known as shaking beef, and it's called shaking beef because traditionally it's like marinated cubes of beef and stir-fried. And the term shaking beef comes from, and actually the Vietnamese phrase for the dish comes from the sort of like sound and action of the beef being stir-fried in the pan. So it kind of like, you know, shakes in the pan. It shakes in the pan.
I can like taste that browned meat.
It's super brown. It's marinated. So it's got like a lot of those, you know, it gets nice and caramelized. So it's just a stir-fried beef dish with some shallots, I think. And we have a, you know, a very flavorful marinade and sauce that kind of like goes into the pan at the last second and sort of coats the beef. And traditionally that's served with like a salad and French fries, I think, in Vietnam. But so to me, when she told me about that dish, the first thing that I thought of was, I love meat with a salad. Like, I love a good meat salad. And so for me, like, I thought of steak frites and I thought of like a steak salad, like a kind of traditional French sort of, I think, interpretation. And so that dish ends up being, I think we started with it. It was beef with sunchokes, because I just love sunchokes, and they're like adjacent to potato. They're like, you know, a root vegetable and starchy. And for me, I thought it was like a great flavor combination. And so that's, so we did the beef with fried sunchokes and then sunchoke chips, and then a watercress salad, because for me, watercress is like so underappreciated, but adds so much flavor. It's like a nice, like peppery contrast. I mean, it goes well with beef particularly. So like all these things, these just kind of came together and it ended up being a really nice dish. And I think right now we changed it to, potatoes just in season. But yeah.
Cool. So you also had after Hong Kong, you spent some time working in academic publishing. Is that correct?
Yes.
Tell us about that chapter of your life.
I like that pun you did.
Thank
that
you.
Chapter.
Thank you.
Publishing. I see that.
I try. Thanks, Mom.
Yeah. So after Hong Kong, I moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I worked in academic publishing for 2 years.
Was it a hard decision to move back to the U.S.? Were you thinking about staying in Asia?
No, I don't think so. At the time, I think I was sort of ready to come back to Earth and figure out what I like actually wanted to do with my life. But so I moved to Cambridge. I really enjoyed working in such... It was like a very intellectual environment, and I think that I found stimulating and really appreciated. And I think what... for me was just, I don't think it was for me in the sense that I had a lot of trouble like working in front of the computer all day. So while I was working there, I ended up taking a part-time job at a restaurant around Inman Square. It's called Bergamot. I started working there, you know, at nights and on the weekends, and just, I think like a lot of people fell in love with the environment, with the community, with the you know, just the pace of the restaurant. Like, for me, I think that was sort of what triggered having second thoughts about what I was going to do with my life.
Had you worked in a restaurant before?
Yeah, so in high school, I was a host at a restaurant called Ruby Palace. And whenever I tell people this, they tell me it sounds like a strip club.
Yeah.
But it was not a strip club. It was a Chinese restaurant that actually my father owned at one point. When he moved to New York, his first job was as a chef. And so I worked at Ruby Palace in high school.
This is in New Jersey?
In New Jersey, yeah.
Is it still there?
It is, the building is still there. The current iteration of the restaurant, I think it has evolved a lot. I think it's some sort of like pan-Asian, gross term, but like pan-Asian sort of like
New Jersey,
suburban.
Home of the
yes,
pan-Asian
yes, exactly.
Cuisine.
Yeah. I mean, we've all, you know, those places, at some point in our lives. So yeah. And it's a very sleazy sort of, restaurant. It's right next
Make
to a motel
like
too, and
like
a like uncool dive bar. It's just, yeah.
But so, you
yeah,
were
that
hostess.
Was my first restaurant job.
Right. So you had an idea of what went on inside of restaurants.
Yeah, but I think at that time I was doing it for the $40 that I made a night. You know, I wasn't sort of like, oh, this is like this is like something I could see myself doing, especially at that particular place.
Was your father's work as a chef, was that something you were aware of as a kid? Were you involved with his work in and around restaurants?
No, so he actually, by the time that my parents had children, he had stopped working in restaurants. Okay. But he cooked pretty much every night at home. So that was really a privilege that I did not appreciate until I got older and started to talking to people who didn't have that when they were growing up.
And I'm sure that just really developed your palate, because knowing like how good food can be, I think like you said, that's like a privilege when your parents can cook well or bake well. You don't realize that.
How good you have it.
You don't realize how good you have it. And, you know, yeah, I was talking to my mom earlier and she was like, why does everybody like, you know, that famous singer sweet potato pies? And I was like, because they didn't have a mother that made really good sweet potato pie. So their frame of reference is just different. Yeah. So you had this amazing, like having these home cooked meals every single night.
And not just, you know, like a dish of something. He would cook like a spread every night. It was, you know, looking back on top of having a full-time job and driving your kids around everywhere. It's admirable.
And how does he feel about your career in restaurants today?
I think that they have reached a point where they are living with it, and generally I think are in a good place, but a lot of work to get there, I would say. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
More work because of the experiences that he had or just unrelated?
Yeah, I'm sure that definitely played into it, just knowing how difficult being a chef is. And he was working like in a basement kitchen in Chinatown like 30 years ago. I can't even imagine how much he was getting paid. Yeah. So I decided to go to culinary school, sort of like as soon as I had the thought that like maybe this was a career that I could see myself doing, I immediately started looking up how to do that. And so I went to culinary school and then moved back to New York after that. And here we are, 7 years.
We are going to take a quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that 90% of Wisconsin's milk is made into cheese? And this is not just any milk. When Swiss, German, and Italian cheesemakers first settled into Wisconsin, they chose their new home because of the special terroir of the region. Its soil and water are nurtured by the goodness of glacial sediment, and those elements lend themselves to the very best milk. Today, Wisconsin produces 25% of all cheeses made in the U.S., and Wisconsin cheeses have won more awards than any other state or country in the world. How do they do it? Wisconsin cheesemakers combine their heritage and tradition with nonstop innovation. They were the first state to establish cheese grade standards and the first to require that every cheese plant be overseen by a licensed cheesemaker. Wisconsin is the only place outside of Europe where one can pursue an elite master cheesemaker certification. All of these impeccably high standards mean Wisconsin produces more than 48% of the nation's specialty cheese.
And we're back. You're listening to Why Food, and we're joined this week by Hannah Wong, who is the executive chef at Van Da, a modern Vietnamese restaurant in Manhattan's East Village. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about the career path that, Hannah, that you've taken to get to where you are today. Let's talk about the process of opening the restaurant. It's fairly new.
Yep.
Tell us that story.
Mm-hmm. We open in March, so it's...
March of this year?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow. Newer than even than I realized. Great. Good thing I did my research.
That's cool. I mean, I guess that means like it may... It's,
it feels like
feels
a...
Like
it feels established. Okay. It feels like a little bit of an a new institution, but an institution.
That's awesome. But yeah, we open in March, so I think it's coming up on, what, 9 months now? The year has flown by, you know, I think... I don't know that I have anything interesting to add about the process of opening a restaurant other than, again, that it is all-consuming and never goes as planned and is a very rewarding and, like, a sadistic kind of way. but we actually have been in that space for 2 years, I want to say. We just never... my boss and I also have a catering company, or she has a catering company that I work for, and so you know, we've just been very busy doing that and didn't really have the time to spend on the renovation and getting all that stuff going. So it took a little while, but yeah, I.
Any particular piece of advice, things that you learned about opening a restaurant that you might want to share with listeners who are thinking about doing it themselves?
I think patience is key, as in many areas of life.
So basically, there's nothing you can do.
Well, that's the thing, right? Because certain things, like getting permits, or, you know, when your contractors disappear for a little while, those things are not in your control. And I think that there is definitely an element of just letting things kind of... not being in control of everything,
right?
Because that is impossible.
That's a thing that happens. Contractors just disappear.
I think I'm being a little like lax in saying that, but
I'm
but,
like, what?
But you know, they'll say they'll do something in a certain amount of time, and then I don't know, maybe they get another job that they have to, you know,
right?
They put you on hold for a little bit.
That makes sense. I mean, so I'm curious actually, because, you know, you stated that your parents were from China and Hong Kong, and your business partner is Vietnamese or Vietnamese descent. And here you are, the executive chef of a Vietnamese restaurant. Did you feel any pressure, or maybe even did you ever like stop and question, like, am I, like, how am I going to best celebrate this food culture that isn't necessarily one that, you know, that I've grown up in, or that my parents even grew up in? Like, what was it like to kind of step into that and really just like lean in to Vietnamese cooking?
Yeah, that's a great question, and something that I have thought about a lot, especially in the last few months. I think when we opened, I didn't... It was just so crazy, and that I didn't have the time to step back and actually think about this issue. And so, we have a great team in place. And so I've had the opportunity recently to sort of take a little bit more time outside the restaurant and reflect on the process. And I think that's one of the things that I've thought a lot about is, who am I to be cooking this food? And especially sort of having my name attached to it, because I don't consider myself Vietnamese. And I think it's been a wonderful experience, I have to say, becoming a part of the Vietnamese culinary community, because I think that everyone in that community, the people that have opened newer Vietnamese restaurants in the last couple years, they are so supportive of each other. And I think they realize the value of this community that they're creating and the voice that they have. I think the perspective that they're bringing, modernizing, I'm going to use quotes on that, modernizing Vietnamese cuisine. But that community, I think, is super supportive, and I'm very much grateful to have been sort of brought into that. I think cooking Vietnamese food for me is very interesting, because I kind of approach it, I try to approach it as sort of like from a more technical perspective, like just sort of taking away Vietnamese, like how do you create a dish that is well composed, that tastes good, that looks good, that's satisfying, that's at the right price point. So I think, you know, part of the reason why my business partner, Ian and I, are successful, I think, is because she understands that she has this vision for the restaurant, for the food that she wants to serve, and then I can provide those sort of other techniques, or you know, just from a more culinary perspective, identifying how we can make these dishes in the way that we want to.
So is that like the answer to the question that you've been reflecting on, which is, you mentioned earlier, you were like, you know, you had a moment, you said, well, who am I to be the person to be attached to this restaurant in Vietnamese cuisine and cooking this food? And I think you kind of answered it beautifully. Like, you're being embraced by the community and you're celebrating the food, the flavors, and the techniques in a way that is also like a financially viable restaurant, mm-hmm. which is kind of amazing and kind of badass.
Thank
That's
you.
Awesome.
yeah, I mean, I think that Vietnamese food is so... For me, one of the best parts of working at the restaurant is feeling like I actually really enjoy eating the food that we serve. I don't think that's often the case for a lot of chefs, especially like chefs that cook fine dining. Like, almost everyone I talk to, they just want a burger at the end of their shift. You know, they're cooking all this fancy ass food and then they want to go home and eat like pizza. Like, they want to go to Roberta's or, you know, just chill out with a burger and beer. So for me, it's really nice feeling, and you know, during service I'm constantly eating because I love the flavors, I love the textures, so for me, like, that's also a huge part of why I like working and think that working at a Vietnamese restaurant is sort of makes sense for me, because I'm so in love with the cuisine right now.
And there really does, it does seem like there's a little bit of a renaissance of particularly regional Vietnamese cooking in the East Village in the last couple of years. There are several restaurants that have opened up where New York City is not, unlike, you know, San Francisco or LA or Minneapolis or cities that are famous sort of for Vietnamese populations and a diversity of Vietnamese cooking. New York City has, I think, historically been pretty straight up and down, like South Vietnamese style pho and
yeah.
related dishes. So what's happened in the last few years in the East Village?
It's a good question. I think a large part of the, to use your term, renaissance, is that there are Vietnamese, children of Vietnamese immigrants who are identifying the absence of certain dishes that they grew up with, or their parents grew up with, or that, you know, they remember eating. And then having the, I think it, a lot of it is financial, having that ability to open a restaurant in New York City. So I kind of feel like that's not an uncommon sort of trend, where immigrants, you know, move to America and then their children sort of take the, whatever, carry the torch in some way. From what I've, you know, the conversations that I've had with some of these restaurateurs and chefs who are Vietnamese, that I feel like that's one thing that they're sort of identifying as a big reason for this sort of rebirth.
Do you find that the dishes that people are most interested in are the things that they may have had before, or are they coming to Venda for the more esoteric, the more specific dishes that you guys make that other people don't?
They're definitely, I think that the most popular dishes on the menu are the more regional things that people haven't had before, which is amazing, because that's exactly what Ian and I talked about when we opened, was really highlighting these dishes. So our menu is divided into four sections now, but we opened with three based on the geography of Vietnam. So some dishes are from Hanoi, some are from Hue, which is sort of central Vietnam, and then from Saigon. Oh, we also have a street food section and now a soup section, so technically five. But regionally, we wanted to focus on sort of identifying the dishes from those regions. And the food from Hue in central Vietnam is really, I think, what people are most like pleasantly surprised that they enjoy eating. And they're also nice because they're smaller, like snacky foods. And I think good for sharing. So historically, Hue is where the royalty in Vietnam like summered. So they, a lot of those dishes are very dainty and elegant. And so, yeah, I've really enjoyed learning how to make those dishes also, because working a lot with like rice, glutinous rice flour and tapioca starch, these are not things that I worked with before and, you know, sort of more American restaurants. So it's, for me, that's the learning curve was a little steep in the beginning, but also very, very satisfying.
You talked about other chefs wanting to chill out with a burger and a beer after a shift. What do you like to eat when you're not working, or what do you cook at home?
I don't cook at home. That's probably not surprising for, let's see.
A bowl of cereal is an acceptable answer.
I do love cereal. Now I use oat milk, but
very fancy.
I don't think you can ever go wrong with a bowl of Honey Nut Cheerios. But what on my days off, I have a few favorite restaurants. I used to come here a lot to Roberta's. I love pizza. Pizza's probably my favorite food if I had to choose one. But yeah, I've been going to Hearts a lot recently. I've been really enjoying their food. I also recently moved, so I'm trying to see what's in the neighborhood around me, and yeah.
Would you talk a little bit about the process of being reviewed in the New York Times? Did you know that Pete Wells was coming? Did somebody spot him in the dining room?
Nope.
How did all of that go down?
Well, we didn't spot him, and then we got a call saying that a photographer from the New York Times was coming, and we were shocked and scared, obviously.
Had you been on the lookout for him? Had it occurred to you that
I might... was sort of aware of the timing, and I was kind of like, okay, this is sort of, you know, it's possible that reviewers are going to start coming in. Let's keep an eye out. We didn't have a wall, you know, I know some restaurants have like a wall of all the reviewers' face, or critics' faces. We didn't have, I mean, we're just so small and bare bones and just like really wanted to focus on the food and just, you know, creating a space that we were proud of. So that it really, I don't think it crossed, if I'm being honest, I don't think it crossed my mind. And I'm not saying that to be humble. I just didn't think it would be on Pete Wells's radar, you know, at this point. But I guess like when did the New Yorker review come out before? I feel like it did come out like slightly before that.
So many reviews. It's so hard to keep them all straight.
So I think after that review, maybe we were kind of like, okay, we might be picking up a little traction. But it was just a pleasant surprise when they called us about the photographer. I don't think we were expecting that for sure. And that's almost kind of the best part, right? Is it happened. We weren't prepared for it in a way, but we were just doing our thing. And it was really nice to get some external validation for that.
How has it changed the business, the flow of customers, the demand for tables?
It definitely popped for a little while after that. I think our business has been pretty steadily solid. You know, I think everyone goes through slow days and slow weeks, and fall is a little tricky with the holidays. But I think overall people, and we've been getting a lot of repeat customers, which honestly at the end of the day is what's going to keep your restaurant in business. So that's been a very positive sign.
That's great.
Excellent. Should we close up with some rapid fire questions?
Oh yeah, fun. Let's do it.
Yeah. I think we need some like we need some fresh new questions.
Can we ask?
No, I prepared for
Hannah, listen to
old
episodes.
I didn't want
episodes.
Them to be rapidly fired at me.
Well, we can for future episodes, we can put this out to our listeners. Maybe listeners will write in on social media or email or all
the
other ways.
Yeah, slide in our DMs with questions for our upcoming guests.
Yeah.
But for today, can I loop in Amanda, our sound engineer?
Hi, Amanda.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Hey, Amanda, can you give us our first rapid-fire question for our guests today?
Be nice, Amanda, please.
You know, I realized I should have spent this time thinking, but I wasn't really thinking. I'll shoot out a few. Hannah, what is your favorite restaurant?
Ugly Baby.
Mm.
Where is that?
It's in Carroll Gardens.
Okay.
Yeah. I used to go there a lot, and then I moved out of the area, so I'm not there as much. But it certainly, in terms of just the vibe and the flavor of the food, absolutely.
Great question, Amanda.
What is your absolute favorite kitchen utensil? The one thing that you couldn't live without?
I think an all-clad pan, just a 10-inch stainless steel all-clad pan.
Yeah. Cool.
You can do everything.
Yeah. Very chefy answer.
Yeah.
Favorite Roberta's pizza. Since we record out of Roberta's essentially,
And we've been trying not to make chewing sounds next to the microphone as we eat the pizza during.
Can I add on to that question?
Yes.
And give you my favorite pizza condiment, because I feel like
that's even better.
So I like pizza that has, generally I would say, red sauce, cheese, some sort of meat and some sort of vegetable, like if it's caramelized onions or, I don't know, like pickled peppers or something like that. But my favorite pizza condiment is Mike's Hot Honey. Mm. There's a restaurant in, I want to say it's like Windsor Terrace, or a pizza place around there, that's the first time that they had it on the table. And then I just started putting it on every single pizza.
Oh my God, that's
so
genius.
Good. Yeah. It's spicy, it's just, and it goes with all the like savory. Oh, it's.
That's so smart.
Can
Ethan.
I say real quick?
Yeah.
Roberta's has like their own kind of version of like.
The bee sting.
Yeah.
Does that have Mike's Hot on it?
I don't think it has Mike's Hot Honey, but it's honey plus chili, right, Amanda?
It's good.
I think so. It's an off menu item, but they'll do it if you ask.
Okay, good to know.
Next
and
time you come,
we
got to
come back. We ask a lot for
it's
that.
It's Valerie's favorite. Amanda, you want to do another rapid fire question?
Yeah, and I don't know if we can hear you, Amanda.
Can you hear me? Hello.
A little quiet, but yeah.
Okay. Favorite fruit?
Persimmons, now because they're in season.
Mm.
Again, a very, in-tuned answer. Very, fine-tuned. Can I ask a follow-up? What do you like to do with persimmons?
Well, I think last night I just cut one up because it was perfectly ripe and put it on yogurt, and then I put crispy shallots on top of that, and it blew my mind. Crispy shallots on top of anything, it just elevates.
It's so good.
It's so good. It's not surprising, right? When I say it, I'm like, of course that would be delicious, but it just hadn't occurred to me to do it before.
I live in Jackson Heights, and Patel Brothers has crispy shallots by the 5-pound pack, and we go through than I'm proud to admit.
But thank you for that little freebie recipe for
tip.
All of us.
Yeah.
Yogurt, persimmon, and crispy shallots.
Yes.
You
just to balance
first.
The burgers out, that's what I do sometimes.
It's going to be the headliner recipe of your cookbook.
I think we should probably wrap it up. One final question, Ethan?
Sure. One final question. If you could live in any time period in human history, what time period would it be? And this can be food related or not, up to you. Time period and place, I guess.
And it can also be the future.
The future?
I know. Are we going to have a future?
No.
I'm not sure.
No, like 2025.
You might not want
to pick the future. That's it. They're calling it.
If you want air and water, I don't know.
God, that is really hard. I think I would probably want to live in Japan or something, and just, I don't know, I've been reading a book called One Straw Revolution, and so I guess maybe like Japanese farming is high on my mind, but I feel like living a very simple, like clean life in like somewhere in the mountains, and maybe like going down to get a bowl of ramen occasionally.
I feel like you're bringing the conversation full circle. Like we're back at this.
I'm all about the full circle. Well,
this idea of Japan, maybe in my mind at least, like the country with the most people specializing in one thing and doing it for their entire lives, and an endless search for unattainable
and
perfection.
And then even time is like not as much of an issue, right? Because it just is. Right, the way that things are.
So. I love that timelessness.
Can I ask one more question? I realized we should have asked because you were a literature major and professional. Can I ask favorite book? Is that too obnoxious? Hannah's wincing.
She looks like, yeah, you look very uncomfortable.
Never mind, forget it.
Fruit on it.
Yeah. It's. I think it's like kind of a thing when people ask about your favorite restaurant or favorite, it's one of those things where like there isn't like one answer.
So something
it just
that,
depends on your mood and
something that you read recently that really stood out that felt different from other things that you've read recently.
On Earth We're Briefly Gorgeous. Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
I like the title.
Yeah.
On Earth We Are Briefly Gorgeous.
A Vietnamese American poet.
Exactly.
Right? Okay, yeah. Ethan.
I don't remember his there name though.
Ocean Vuong.
There we go.
And that's your room.
And on that note, Hannah, how can we find you? Tell us your social media, where your restaurant is located exactly. How can we find you and how can we eat your delicious food?
Sure. Vanda is in the East Village on 4th Street between A and B. You can find me there most nights. On Instagram, I'm at Hannah C. Wong. And Vanda's Instagram is at VandaNYC, I think.
Awesome. And as always, you can reach us via email, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org. You can find me via my spice company at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram or Ethan at burlapandbarrel.com.
And you can find me on Instagram at foodieinnewyork or my website, foodieinnewyork.com.
And I would also just like to remind you, it is the end of the year, which is a great time to make donations to all of the amazing nonprofit organizations that do important work in our city, in our country, in our world. One of those organizations is Heritage Radio Network, the fruits of whose labor you are enjoying right now at this very moment. If you go to heritageradionetwork.org, you'll see a beating heart icon, which hopefully you will relate to because it is your beating heart listening to amazing podcasts like this one. Make a donation. We depend on your support, and we really appreciate it. Thanks to Amanda, our amazing sound engineer, and to the Red Crickets for our theme song, which is called Blind.
And this is our last show of the season.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Our last show of the season. Ooh, oh, good. Wow. I was going to show up next week.
Oh, cool. I made that up. I totally made that up. Please come back next week, Ethan. In my head, it's December 19th. I'm living in the future.
When Valerie picks her one time period, it's going to be next Thursday. All right. Hannah, thanks for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you, guys.
See you next week.
See you next week. YFood is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.